is aggregate these buyers together, convene steel purchases, and to coordinate an actual offtake agreement. So we're translating these corporate commitments into this agreement, so that'll support the actual producers to make investments to get, if it's hydrogen or if it's CCS or another way to produce this clean steel. So connecting the demand to the supply in order to make these new clean facilities happen.
She's a principal at the Rocky Mountain Institute, Chathu Gamage. Chathu, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Chris Joss, Walter Egan, Tenacious D.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Could I get two of those zucchini, please?
Sure. Anything else for you today?
What is that over in the basket?
Oh, honey, that is the organic, homegrown More Talk Radio with Cecile Prescott and Celeste Carey.
Wow, I'll take one.
It is so great. Every Monday at 8 in the morning.
How do I get more?
Well, you can support programs like this with donations by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. It is the Fresh Off the Vine Fall Fun Drive, so it's a great time to give.
More Talk Radio sounds nutritious. I can't wait to try it.
Oh, honey, you're gonna love it.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street in Portland. Día de los Muertos is an ancient celebration originating from the indigenous people of Mexico. Festivities will include altar creation, muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, and live musical performances. Again, that's the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street, 831 Southeast Salmon Street in Portland.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
Hello, and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today we are speaking with Jason Valdez.
Buffalo existed from the West Coast nearly all the way to the East Coast, to Florida, from Mexico to the Arctic, from sea level to 13,000 feet in elevation. There really is not a place on this continent where buffalo doesn't belong. And if we can continue to restore buffalo to its rightful places, those places are also going to heal.
Jason, an enrolled member of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe, received both his bachelor's and master's degree in land resources and environmental sciences from Montana State University, where he focused on the restoration of buffalo bison to tribal lands. In 2016, he spearheaded the successful effort to relocate a herd to the Wind River Indian Reservation and worked with both the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes in buffalo management and expansion. He is an advocate, educator, and speaker on Indigenous cultural revitalization and ecological restoration, who has also served as director of the Wind River Native Advocacy Center, where he was instrumental in the passing of the Wyoming Indian Education for All Act. He currently splits time as executive director of the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative, the Tribal Buffalo Program Senior Manager for the National Wildlife Federation's Tribal Partnerships Program. Jason sits on the board of directors of the Intertribal Buffalo Council and the board of trustees for the Conservation Lands Foundation. Well, hello, Jason. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Gosh, there is so much to talk about, and I'm really excited to get the chance to talk to you. As we start, I want to get a bit of background about your journey towards working with buffalo restoration. And so maybe we could start off with what led you down this path and what has continually affirmed your commitment to the buffalo?
Well, growing up on the Wind River Reservation, I was part of a family who hunted and fished and camped. My dad is a retired fish and wildlife biologist. And so as a young person, I got to witness a lot of his work firsthand in protecting fisheries, fighting for water rights, upholding the sovereignty and self-determination of the tribes to restore species that were exterminated, like the pronghorn antelope and bighorn sheep. So I was a kid when I witnessed the reintroduction of those species. And then I had the opportunity when I was 18 to travel with my dad to East Africa and witness the wildebeest migration, along with seeing many of the other wildlife species there in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. And the wildebeest was kind of an epiphany for me, realizing that that's less than 5% of what the bison was here on this continent less than 500 years ago, actually less than 200 years ago. And so I had a newfound maybe appreciation for my home and my community. And so when I returned home from Africa, I decided to pursue an education that would give me the academic credentials to move forward in bison restoration on the Wind River Indian Reservation here in Wyoming, working closely with the Eastern Shoshone, my own tribe, as well as the Northern Arapaho, who we share this reservation with. We both come from buffalo people. It was very important, critical for my grandmas and grandpas. And so, you know, kind of taking the lead from my father, stepped into a role where I could help, you know, the four-leggeds, the buffalo, as well as, you know, the other species that benefit from their presence. And once I finished with my education, I moved into a professional role with the National Wildlife Federation, and then a position with the Intertribal Buffalo Council as the representative for the Shoshone tribe, and then starting a nonprofit to work closely with the two tribes here to further buffalo expansion on the reservation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much for that work. I would just love to continue hearing more about the specific projects you're working on right now, and what are some new developments in the space?
Well, the reservation was opened up for homesteading way back in 1906, and this privatized many of our reservation lands. They're no longer really considered part of the reservation. They're considered fee lands or allotted lands. And so I've been able to raise some dollars to reacquire or purchase those properties for buffalo habitat. And so that's kind of what I've been saying is rematriation, that we're getting these lands restored to the tribes. You know, we're no longer trespassers on these lands, and they will for now in perpetuity belong to buffalo, and ensuring that buffalo have a place here. So buffalo restoration is land rematriation, which is a form of reconciliation that people can literally buy into. Help us buy these fee lands back for buffalo habitat that can be returned to the reservation or trust status. And that creates a new future for our people, a reconnection to Buffalo, but also a return of some of these lands that were illegitimately taken from our grandmas and grandpas way back in 1906 or even before, with the Homestead Act or the General Allotment Act that opened up reservations for homesteading. The tribes also recently dedicated a range unit. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is the land managing agency. It's a federal agency that oversees things on reservations, and BIA manages our lands, and they've divided it into 92 range units that have had a priority in cattle production, despite our successes in conservation, like the very first wilderness area, protection of game or species with the game code, reintroduction of pronghorn antelope and bighorn sheep, and even in the 90s, protection of wolves and bears, predators on the reservation. So there's a history of conservation success stories, and despite all that, the Bureau of Indian Affairs continues to promote cattle production on these range units. And so we've been able to change the priority on a couple of those range units to prioritize buffalo. Those are now buffalo habitat, and so I'm raising the dollars through the nonprofit, the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative, to pay for the infrastructure needs of expansion to a larger land base. So there's community, there's leadership support from both tribes to continue building our buffalo programs. That's very important for the ecological role of this keystone species being restored to the landscape. That increases plant and animal biodiversity. It's important in carbon storage and climate resiliency. For the people here, though, it's very important culturally and spiritually. This was the first year in 139 years that the Shoshone tribe's been able to take our own animals from our own lands for our annual Sundance ceremonies. That's very, very important. Last year was the first time for the Arapaho. And so, you know, integrating that buffalo back into the ceremonies of our peoples here is very important in our healing. What's also important in our healing is being able to eat buffalo again. The nutritional benefits of this animal, highest in protein, minerals, and vitamins, and lowest in fat and cholesterol than nearly every other meat. So nutritionally, it's very important to integrate buffalo back into our diet, into our elder programs, into our school lunch programs. We know that if we feed our children buffalo, because it's in our DNA, that this heals us from the inside out. And we have some studies to show that Native children eating buffalo will improve test scores and cognitive ability. And so it really is about healing the land as well as healing ourselves from, you know, this effort to exterminate buffalo. You know, we can restore that cultural, spiritual, educational, and academic and nutritional reconnection that's so important in our communities today.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking us through some of those points. And I would like to talk a bit more about the complexities of conservation and land rematriation and fee title. And maybe even in your response, you could speak to how people can support that effort.
Sure. We have to think pretty deliberately about what was imposed on Native people. You know, for the tribes, not only the two here on the Wind River Reservation, but others regionally and across the country, there's a foundational understanding and interconnectedness and interrelatedness. The importance of wolves and bears, for instance, is a demonstration of the tribes working to protect that animal, is because we understand they have an important role to play. That's a holistic or an ecological worldview, and what was imposed upon us was really this model of exploitation or progress that's based in the idea of manifest destiny. you know, that these things that are here are for the benefit of man. And for much of the country, which has been plowed up or paved over, fenced in, fenced out, it's disrupted the interconnectedness and the interrelatedness of many species, the corridors, the populations of wildlife, the wildland-urban interface, even the how fire is used, all have come from this colonial worldview. And so this colonial worldview is what's where we base agriculture, how we have created policies like the prior appropriation doctrine about how water is used, the use it or lose it philosophy. That's not a very holistic model. It's about exploitation of the resource for the benefit and monetary gain or commodification for man. If we think about how we bridge Western science and indigenous science, it brings in these ideas of interconnectedness and interrelatedness. And that's why oftentimes conservation is aligned with indigenous values and belief systems, because it's really to restore the ecological balance that was here prior to lands and communities being colonized. So we're in an era today where we can focus on cultural revitalization, language preservation. We can think differently about how lands are utilized, the importance of buffalo or bison, you know, reintegrated into the communities for the healing that needs to take place. This is going to create a better future for our young people. And if we look at reservations, because of that General Allotment Act, many of our reservations are checkerboarded with jurisdiction, from the fee title land to the allotted lands to tribal land. Even states that are assuming jurisdiction on many of those fee lands on reservations. Our reservations were created to maintain a way of life, and that way of life was disrupted with the extermination of the buffalo when we became reliant upon the federal government for rations. And then there was the boarding school era where our grandmas and grandpas were forced from their homes to go to schools where colonization and even indoctrination was, you know, very influential in our people. So that's part of the intergenerational trauma that we're trying to heal. And as we bring buffalo back and get them into ceremonies and we get them back into the diet, that's all part of our healing, which is very important. And the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative was established so that we could not only raise money to acquire more land, but also facilitate the cultural, educational, nutritional reconnection of youth and community to buffalo. So for instance, next week we have a 3-day youth camp taking place out here at the buffalo so that our elementary and middle school and high schoolers are learning about our efforts to protect fisheries and water, our wildlife and buffalo, and ensuring that our young people are very knowledgeable and grounded in that relationship, those relationships, so that we are creating better leaders for the future. And so the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative was set up to help facilitate that. You can go to the website, www.windriverbuffalo.org. We have a donate button on that webpage, but you can also learn about the effort, learn about the history of the two tribes here on this reservation, as well as see some videos and some articles concerning or related to buffalo restoration.
Thank you.
to talk a little bit more about the differences between buffalo and cattle, because I think a lot of people associate buffalo with cattle, thinking that they take up the same role in an ecosystem, but as you know, they're actually quite different. So could you explain the varying roles that they have?
Yeah. Well, first off, cattle came from Europe, and cattle brought a lot of diseases that infected the wildlife. You hear a lot about brucellosis. We hear less about malignant catarrhal fever and Mycoplasma bovis. These are livestock diseases that are fatal to buffalo, but more often than not, we hear about this brucellosis argument, and it is really unfounded. We've been able to mitigate that disease to ensure that animals can be certified as disease-free and ensure that those genetics are supplementing some of our other herds. And so disease often is one that you hear about between cattle and buffalo, but just to make that clarification is important. Buffalo, bison, I use that term interchangeably. Buffalo is a common term amongst tribal communities. Of course, the scientists argue that bison is the correct term, but you know, the correct term for us is the language, is the name in our languages. And so, you know, there's 330 plus languages indigenous to this continent. And so buffalo, bison, they cannot be replaced on the landscape by cattle. Buffalo have unique grazing characteristics. Their physiological behavioral adaptations make them beneficial to the landscape. They will do patchwork grazing where they graze heavily in certain areas and leave adjacent patches of grass completely left alone. This creates microhabitats for other organisms, but it also keeps the soils from drying out. The same area that cattle would use, they would graze it down and expose the soil and dry it out. Buffalo will also graze on the grasses. They're primarily graminoid feeders. And that's why you have an increase in biodiversity of plants, is because they focus on the grasses and leave the forbs. They have the ability to control their metabolism, to slow it down, so they can rely on less favorable forage when needed. Buffalo are also drought tolerant. They need less water than cattle. And buffalo won't congregate in riparian areas. They will go down and take a drink, and then they'll move. They actually move about 3 miles per day if they have the landscape available to them. A buffalo has 22,000 hairs per square inch, compared to about 7,000 hairs for a cow. So a buffalo can withstand extreme temperatures, cold temperatures, because of the hair and the fur that they put on. In the springtime, when they lose that hair, it becomes available to many other organisms that need it for their nests. Certain birds need buffalo hair for their eggs to reach the right incubation temperature. You don't get that with cattle. That hair gets carried down into the ground by mammals. It changes the soil chemistry. Buffalo also have this unique behavior where they wallow, creating these depressions on the landscape that's important for seed dispersal, but also water accumulation and groundwater recharge. These wallows become microhabitats to reptiles, amphibians, insects. And so as it rains and snows, these wallows fill with water. And so that's important for the animals, but it's also important for the soils. You know, they just have a whole host of things that make them beneficial on the land. Cattle cannot replace the hair, cannot replace their grazing style on the landscape. And so, you know, that argument really doesn't hold up anymore, because we know and can see and witness the influence that bison or buffalo have on the landscape, that you just don't see it with cattle. Actually, with cattle, you have a decrease in plant and animal biodiversity because they don't provide those things that I've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoy hearing the specific examples of how, you know, they work as ecosystem engineers. It's really incredible. And there's a quote from migrating bison engineer, the Green Wave, from the National Academy of Science, where scientists explain that, quote, prior to European settlement, 28 to 30 million plains bison roamed North America, migrating in vast groups across immense latitudinal and elevational gradients. Overhunting virtually eliminated North American bison such that by 1900, only a few hundred remained, 26. Today, bison occupy less than 1% of their historic range. A remnant population of up to 5,500 animals in Yellowstone National Park, which still migrate up to 100 kilometers, is the last truly migratory herd, end quote. Yeah, so I'm wondering, how does the current American landscape reflect the deep influence of buffalo in the past, and what are we losing in their absence?
Well, you know, I focused my undergraduate and graduate degrees around tribal buffalo restoration, and for my thesis, it took me some time to come up with, but I recall seeing, you know, my dad pointing out these relic wallows growing up as a kid when we were hunting in the northern boundary of our reservation, hunting elk and deer and antelope. But he would point out these depressions that were on the land, that they were made by buffalo, even though buffalo haven't been there for over 140 years. There are still these depressions that these buffalo created. And so digging in the literature, I found some articles about cultural plants, foods, tools, and medicines that were associated with relic wallows in the tallgrass prairie further east. And there was very little in the literature about high elevation desert plants, cultural plants that were associated with wallows. And so that kind of became my research project, was going out in the northern boundary of the reservation and measuring cultural plant biodiversity within these relic wallows, and comparing that to the plant biodiversity outside of the relic wallows, suggesting that, you know, maybe these relic wallows still serve a purpose in the abundance of these plants. And so I measured plant biodiversity on 75 wallows randomly sampled from over 100 to measure that. And so the data suggested that there is several plants that still benefit from the presence of these wallows as opposed to them not being there, suggesting that these relic wallows do serve a purpose in cultural plant biodiversity in a high elevation desert ecosystem like we have here. You know, when there were 28 to 30 million, that's actually a conservative estimate. We think that there could have likely been 60 million buffalo across the continent. That if there were, you know, millions of buffalo, that there would have been equally millions of these wallows. And that would have been very important for the water accumulation, for the microhabitats, what the buffalo did for biodiversity. Now being, you know, 1% or less than 1% on their former range, we obviously lack those wallows. And you get up in the air on an airplane and you fly east and you look down on the ground, it's carved up into squares and circles that is evidence of, you know, that idea of progress or manifest destiny, that all of the land is here for man's benefit. There is few places where there is still intact migratory pathways for ungulates to utilize, water bodies, you know, migrating birds can use. We see a decrease in biodiversity of birds and amphibians across the world. Globalization has really influenced the animal kingdom. And, you know, when you have millions of buffalo, you would have also had, you know, a 10% die-off rate that would have really been important for the soil as these buffalo died, were predated upon, or other species utilized as carrion, you know, these buffalo bodies would have disintegrated and provided extensive nutrients to the soil. Most of these lands now are turned into monocultures. They're also inoculated or fertilized with synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and insecticides. And so there's just a lot of people don't think about the Dust Bowl as also being a result of the extermination of the buffalo, because if the buffalo was gone, then it made way for these people coming in to utilize those lands for agriculture. These were grasslands that were millions of years old and had been formed over that period of time from the presence of buffalo, and that was all, you know, drastically disrupted with westward expansion and colonization. So, you know, the landscape is obviously much different today than it was prior to European arrival. And so we're not going to see 30 to 60 million buffalo in our lifetime. But there is plenty of opportunity to restore buffalo to specific landscapes where they can exist and effectively create the ecological change that we need to see. But we have to reprioritize or question what our motive is as a society. Most of it, again, is based on exploitation or commodification or what you can gain monetarily. For us as tribes, it's much more about the interconnectedness and the interrelatedness, the holistic reciprocal relationship that we have with our food and our water and our land. And so, you know, the hope is that, you know, what we do here on this Wind River Reservation for buffalo restoration, that there's can be some lessons learned there that we can apply to other areas, other public lands that belong to all Americans, where we can think differently about what we want to see for our future, what we want to put back that was taken from us, and do some restorative justice for the buffalo, but also the people that depended upon them. And also now that it's, you know, widely recognized, you know, with media like the Ken Burns American Buffalo film, with some of the issues around Yellowstone, that the American people are gaining access to a little bit more knowledge and taking that energy and supporting efforts like what we're doing here at Wind River to reacquire land for buffalo habitat, but also restore this buffalo protected as a wildlife species. And that's going to be able to maybe, you know, give us a little bit of hope, or give a hope for our young people for the future, that it's not as colonial as it once was, and that we can actually exercise our sovereignty and self-determination to create the change that we want to see.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for all your work and excited to see the shift, and really kind of sitting with the complicated place that buffalo has lived within the quote American imaginations, you know, because they have represented both this odd colonial idea of freedom, you know, thinking of the wide open plains and the land where the buffalo roam, but also something to be controlled. So I'm just holding that complexity of the belief system around buffalo and who gets control of them and why, but also maintaining this idea of manifest destiny and the open lands of the American West. And I can only imagine that these ideologies continue to try and control and manipulate the way that bison get reintroduced, and yeah, who gets to control the fate and the future of them.
Yeah, the Western paradigm is like you say, much about control. And you can look at cattle as an example of that. I believe that you know, any intelligence that cattle once had was bred out of them so that they could be easier to handle by human beings. They became reliant upon human beings for, you know, for feeding themselves, for even calving. A buffalo doesn't need our help. The buffalo does just fine on its own if it has food and water and each other as a herd animal. And so, you know, I think actually buffalo are easier than cattle because they don't need as much care. Not that we're trying to, you know, ranch buffalo, but we had to start small in order to grow for them to exist. And so there is a relationship there. I go out and I see the buffalo every day. They're used to seeing me on the side-by-side, but they are not in any way domesticated. These animals can exist without me being there or checking up on them or doing anything because they are very intelligent. You know, they're just conscious of their surroundings. They know what's going on. There's a millennia-old relationship there that Native people had. It's in our DNA, that the buffalo have. It's in their DNA, and that's that reciprocal relationship. We aren't trying to domesticate buffalo, but they are well used to seeing me and others there visiting them. They know what's going on, but it's not like they're a pet, or it's not like they're domesticated. They, you know, this is a seed population of various genetics. Our herd comes from 6 different sources of conservation genetics. And once they have a large enough land base to roam around on, they will distance themselves from human beings like any other animal would. And so I think people get confused a bit because buffalo exists in the world as livestock, but it also exists in the world as wildlife. And it's really up to us as human beings to kind of dictate what kind of scenario we want to see with buffalo. And that makes them unique in that, you know, we don't do that with elk or deer or moose or bighorn sheep or pronghorn antelope. Those are wildlife. Buffalo has this interesting way about itself that allows that relationship. And I really truly believe that's because of the genetic memory between buffalo and the native people. And I think that's why people get into bison ranching, is because the buffalo is this iconic species, this magnificent being, this great beast of an animal. But it really is up to us as human beings to take care of that buffalo the way that it used to take care of us. And that's why I'm very focused on ensuring that they can be protected as wildlife and exist as such on this reservation. Because growing up with that, my biologist father, you know, he helped to instill the way buffalo should be treated. And that is like those other species. And so it's very important that we continue to move in that direction, in that paradigm shift.
Yeah. And going back to some of what you were speaking to around the restoration and even comparing the domestication of cattle and buffalo, I'm wondering, when we allow buffalo to roam freely rather than keeping them contained, how does their migration impact the environment?
Well, like you mentioned, that green wave, you know, buffalo would follow that and enhance it as the seasonal vegetation cover changes throughout the growing season. I know buffalo will move about 3 miles a day. They, you know, do their wallowing. They don't have to go to water sources as often as cattle do. They will have, you know, birds following them. We, you know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has listed the ferruginous hawk, the mountain plover, and the burrowing owl as species of concern. And We noticed that those species come back, along with many others, when buffalo are restored. And so, you know, as we put buffalo back on the landscape and they can grow in population, we can anticipate seeing an increase in birds, insects, even mammals over time. And the plant community change over time because of their selective grazing. They're pollinating when they walk with their beards. They spread seed when they wallow. And so you would see the formation of these wallows even, and trail systems. You know, a buffalo doesn't know where to go until it learns that. You know, a buffalo doesn't just instinctively have, you know, an urge to you know, get out and go to Yellowstone, which I've actually heard before. They have to learn what's available to them, and then they utilize that. And that's why when we started on 300 acres, you know, those animals learned that 300 acres. We've now grown to 2,000 acres. The buffalo have learned where they can go and get water and eat specific plants in that 2,000 acres. It's no different when we expand their habitat. They're going to go and they're going to find out what the perimeter is, and they're going to learn what's available to them. They have a homing instinct, and so there's been over 40 calves born on this ground where we started, and so this is going to always be a place that those buffalo will return to. And that's something that I've come to learn and understand as I've spent more time with buffalo, is that they have those behavioral characteristics that are innate, and once they learn what they know and what they can have access to, that's what they use. And so just learning from them and watching has been really beneficial, and it's been part of my healing as well, to be able to spend time with buffalo and get them into the ceremonies and being able to eat buffalo more regularly. It's certainly part of my healing, my family, and community members that now have access to buffalo in the diet. And that's only going to increase as we build our population and ensure these animals can exist here, protected as wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing about that. And I was reading from the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative, and it says, quote, "Buffalo back on the Wind River Reservation signifies change, a return to the beliefs and values held by our grandmas and grandpas. We are helping them so they can once again help us. They are here once again for our nutrition, ceremony, and tradition. The buffalo have been absent from our lives for over 130 years, but the teachings are not forgotten," end quote. I would just love to hear more about how does connection to these modern buffalo also bring about connection to past generations?
It certainly does. You know, our ceremonies were outlawed up until 1978 with the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. Fortunately for our tribes here, we were able to keep secret the songs, the ceremonies, the rituals, the protocols, the practices, despite it being illegal for many decades. And so, you know, not all tribes can lay claim to that. Many tribes lost their languages. Many tribes lost their ceremonies. Many tribes lost semblance of who they were. Fortunately for many of the tribes out west, because of the period of time, we were able to hold on to these things. And so as we restore that buffalo to ceremonies, as we provide it again, a relationship again, there is the feeling that our ancestors' prayers are being answered, that there were our grandmas and grandpas who were praying for what we're seeing happen now. And so we feel their presence. We don't believe that they're gone. We believe that our ancestors are still here with us. And so that part of the healing, the songs that can be sung again in ceremony, you know, that is the result, I think, of many, many people's prayers before us coming to fruition in front of our eyes, you know, today. So I certainly do believe that our grandmas and grandpas are still with us, and it's the spirit of the buffalo, it's the spirit of our people before us that are helping to ensure that this relationship, this identity of our people can remain.
Tribal Buffalo Initiative, which writes, quotes, "We need healing. The evidence of loss of connection manifests as addiction, trauma, and unhealthy behaviors that is not of our traditional belief systems. There is potential for healing and recovery from addiction or trauma in finding inspiration from buffalo and a reconnection to Mother Earth and our relatives found in nature." And I've read you say, quote, "We offer visits to the buffalo herds for individual and groups in recovery." And love to hear if you have any stories to share about these programs that you support or anything that brings you the hope that you've seen.
You know, we have the social dilemma of our circumstances in our communities is challenging. You know, we have, I think, 12-year lower life expectancy than the national average. We have high suicide rates, high high school dropout rates, and other problems that is directly attributable to the intergenerational trauma. A lot of people turn to alcohol, substance abuse, even gambling, as a coping mechanism to deal with that trauma. And that isn't healthy for us. It's not good for us. It's not ensuring that our people have a foundation to grow from. And even my own struggles with alcohol, I've been able, you know, I've got over 5 years of sobriety now, that I found my help in Buffalo. I found my help in returning to ceremony, and really, you know, submersing myself in this work to help the Buffalo, to help, you know, myself, to help my family, my community, from many of these issues that we all face, that touch all of our families in some way or another. And if we look across the country at other tribes and the things that they're doing, and for instance, the Intertribal Buffalo Council now has a membership of 82 or 83 tribes, restoring buffalo for the cultural and spiritual importance. It's very similar. It's also restoring ancestral foods, eating healthier, thinking more holistically about how we treat our bodies, what we're ingesting, how we treat each other, a holistic medicine wheel approach to thinking about our growth and development as human beings. That medicine wheel philosophy is integrated into everything that we do, and it's a very big part of our healing. And buffalo are really foundational to that, and I don't really know how to describe it other than it's in our ceremonies, it's in the lessons that we learn as we, you know, transcend the four hills of life from baby, youth, to adult, to elder. It's in the balance that we find mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. that medicine wheel is kind of the paradigm, is the worldview that our grandmas and grandpas had. And that's what we're trying to help our people with in finding their own healing. And when you find balance mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, and you can integrate that medicine wheel thinking and belief system into your everyday life, well, that is part of restoring what was taken from us. And that's foundational to our healing, whether it's moving away from alcohol or substance abuse or any kind of addiction that we may have or carry. And so, you know, healing myself and finding sobriety and recovery was because of Buffalo, because of the work or the platform that it allowed me to work from. And I wanted to be able to share that with anyone else that can relate, tribal or even non-tribal. But because we as Native people carry around this intergenerational trauma, it's very important to include those that are in recovery. And that's why the people that are in recovery, those recovery programs you mentioned, continue to come out to the Buffalo. It's not to learn from me, but it's to learn from the Buffalo, to go sit with the Buffalo and find that healing that we all need. And so it's just an important way to provide that place. And sitting with the Buffalo can remind people about a part of themselves that they never knew was there.
Beautiful. Along with the Buffalo, I also wanted to take a moment and think about the beauty of the prairie. You know, there's so much in a prairie that I think gets overlooked. And there's so much vitality that also potentially gets overlooked. And so just wondering if you could speak to the beauty you find in the prairie and the power there.
Yeah, there's, I think, not only about the prairie, but I think about the rivers, the river bottoms, the mountains, the high mountain meadows. You know, Buffalo existed from the West Coast nearly all the way to the East Coast, to Florida, from Mexico to the Arctic, from sea level to 13,000 feet in elevation. And so there really is not a place on this continent where Buffalo doesn't belong. And I truly believe that if we can continue to restore Buffalo to its rightful places, that those places are also going to heal. And it's the plants, it's the birds, it's the insects, it's the other four-legged animals that are out there. It's even the microbiology, the soils and the microbes that will all benefit from Buffalo. And I hope to see it in my lifetime where Buffalo exists, you know, on hundreds of thousands of acres in populations greater than 1,000, you know, thousands of Buffalo on hundreds of thousands of acres. I think that's foreseeable in our lifetime. And for me personally, a lot of this work is so that one day I can hunt buffalo with my kids and grandkids and hopefully my dad. You know, that, you know, a lot of this work that I'm involved in wouldn't have been possible without the effort of many who've come before. And for me, my dad is my hero for the work that he did to buck the system, to fight against what he didn't believe in, and to be an advocate for the fish and the wildlife and those that don't have a voice. And so, you know, there's a whole lot of work that goes into getting to that point where buffalo actually exist on large landscapes. That's still a lofty goal in this day and age. I think it's achievable, but we have still a lot of challenges ahead to get to that. to challenge the paradigm, to change the status quo, to challenge others' belief systems, to call out manifest destiny and the notion of progress when needed. You know, those are challenges that I think are becoming a bit more achievable as people want to see and support a different way of doing things that isn't exploitative, but is more holistic and ecological in nature. So I hope someday that I will be able to hunt a buffalo with my kids and grandkids, or even more importantly, to be able to do that with my dad would be one of the greatest rewards that there could ever be.
Yeah, I feel that, Jason. For those of us who want to get more involved and support this effort, what are ways that the everyday individual can support? And maybe for those listening who have a bit more ability to give or support, what are ways that can happen?
Yeah, a lot of our expenses are for land acquisition. And even though our lands were bought and sold for pennies per acre back in 1906, they're now worth about $6,000 per acre. If we had $20 million right now, for instance, we could lock up 10,000 acres of fee land on the reservation that could be put into the land in the trust process. It would be turned into buffalo habitat. And so that's an extensive request. However, we also need, you know, funding for providing more jobs, you know, to ensure that we can engage young people and community members to pay for infrastructure as we expand habitat. And so the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative was really set up as a nonprofit to bring in resources from outside of the reservation so that we don't have to rely upon either tribe, who have limited resources and definitely don't have money for land acquisition. And so ensuring that the tribes can continue to build our buffalo program, the Tribal Buffalo Initiative was set up so that we could facilitate that land acquisition to support the tribes in getting more habitat and integrate it into the diet and into the lives of our community members again. For people that want to support this work, please go to the website, windriverbuffalo.org, navigate through there to the donate page and provide as much as you can, $5, $10 or more. It's all going to support the efforts of the Tribal Buffalo Initiative. And we're just appreciative of all of the support that continues to grow and build from not only the people here on the reservation, obviously, but also people in the state of Wyoming and also nationwide as well as worldwide. There's interest from other countries, and we've had visitors from India, from Switzerland, from other countries in Africa. You know, there's people are conscious of history, and people realize some of the atrocities that happen, and supporting the Tribal Buffalo Initiative and getting not only buffalo restored but getting land back is a real form of reconciliation that people can literally buy into, help us get these lands restored for buffalo, and support the efforts of the Tribal Buffalo Initiative to get this animal integrated back into our lives again.
Oh, Jason, thank you so much for your time and for sharing these thoughts and stories and hopes with us. I'm really moved and feel like I want to continue learning more.
Well, appreciate the invitation to join you on the conversation today. I think it's really important that people learn about this history and understand how, you know, we can actually effectively create the change we want to see today.
Thanks for listening to For the Wild. The music in today's episode is by Jamie Stone and A.R. Wilson, with special thanks to Patience Records. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Julia Jackson, Jackson Krupp, Jose Alejandro Rivera, and Evan Tenenbaum.
There is more love somewhere. There is more love somewhere. I'm gonna keep on until I find it. There is more love somewhere. There is more peace somewhere. There is more peace.
This is Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my email. It is often mentioned as one of the most progressive and daring stations that we have in this country. They are not afraid to tell you the truth. So tune in to KBOO Portland and get the real word.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the... Ah, I don't like my mom.